on what has transpired today, and they'll also pass your presentation to the ministry department. And we do have members of parliament from the ruling party and from the main opposition party, that's the ANC and DA. The other parties' ideas tendered an apology, and Dr. Mulder from the Freedom Front Plus has tendered an apology. My only regret is that they are not here. I think it's important that for them to receive this input from a stakeholder that's outside the media process that we are always engaged in. That being the case, I would think that today would be the beginning of a process that continues. I don't see it as perhaps a once-off. From your presentation, obviously members are going to engage with your presentation, interrogate, comment, ask questions. And then in that manner, it will lay a basis for the way forward. After that long introduction, welcome again, gentlemen. So, as soon as you are ready, we are in your able hands. I'm not sure how you have distributed the responsibilities. There's a session where you just on.
Well, I think, do you want to
Well, yes.
How are you doing? Honorable Chairperson, members of the committee, I represent the shareholder within PATCO. Represent a company called Wabakeng Holding, which is the investment arm of the Wabakeng community out in the Northwest. Generally, I think from our point of view as a shareholder, the mandate we have put on PATCO is one which is pretty tight, because we, through our investment vehicle, we use the money that we get from the dividends that our companies that invest and pay us to develop our community. But for PATCO, in this case, they need to give us the profit also to help us keep our investment in check so far as the intelligence that we require and the integrity that we require within our investments. So I think really the partnership that they're going to us investing in PATCO was more from a strategic partnership point of view, to see that you know, we don't just fruitlessly invest in things that don't, you know, see the end of our objectives and provide furthering the interests of our people. So really, I'm just here as a shareholder to see that they represent us well in this meeting today. Mark.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson and members of the committee. I think the amount, to be honest, the Chairman, the number of people is not the key issue. I think it's the message that and the importance given to it. So I'd be delighted if this is the first of a series of engagements on the matter. The I think thank you, Botata, for sort of giving a bit of background. I'm not here to sort of talk too much about PATCO, but just so you know who we are and put it in context, PATCO is a South African, wholly South African-owned company, risk management company that's been in existence for about 13 years. We do a range of advisory and risk management services for government and corporate sectors. And we've, in the past, worked very closely with some government departments and units such as the Special Investigation Unit, the Revenue Services, Department of Justice, the Asset Forfeiture Unit, the former Scorp Philippines, South African police services, etc., etc. And part of our key focus has been this very important topic of integrity risk management. It's a personal passion of mine, so I'm, in 2 seconds, a academic by background. I used to be a clinical psychologist, taught at University of Cape Town and Rhodes University in the Eastern Cape, and got very interested in integrity and compliance, and particularly around the time of the political transformation in the country in the early 1990s, which I know we were commemorating the 20 years of it, and it suddenly made me feel very old, thinking that I've been dealing with this issue, this topic, for 20 years. But apart from that, and I was very pleased when the suggestion came that possibly this is something that might be of interest to this committee and more broadly to the department, the ministry. And the key reason for that is the Department of Home Affairs, as any government department or any government entity, has a certain vested interest in maintaining a positive reputation and effectiveness. And although I'm not intimately familiar with the turnaround strategy, I'm aware of the DHA's turnaround strategy. And the key issue there is a, much like any company, any corporation, a family, a school, any government department, it's the concept of visible integrity that's important. And when we say visible integrity, we mean the people that interact with your department on a daily basis need to see and almost touch and feel integrity. So at a very simple level, if it's possible to walk into a Home Affairs office somewhere in the country and walk out a short while later with a false identity book, that is not visible integrity. If one walks in, tries to acquire a false identity book and is let out in handcuffs, that is visible integrity. So when we say visible integrity, we mean demonstrable, something that is obvious and becomes obvious to the common public. Now, sound integrity management can be the bedrock of any turnaround strategy. I mean, our company has assisted many corporate clients to turn around in moments of disaster or near disaster. Interestingly, those moments of disaster are often caused by a loss of integrity within the company, or what we call failed integrity. So a rogue trader is the most obvious example, who can drive the bank of bearings down or threaten any sort of major trading company. But we've also seen that a lack of emphasis on integrity management within companies or departments can inhibit any strategy. And I think the key message that we've always tried to promote is that integrity management, the emphasis is on management as much as on integrity. It's not something that just happens by itself in any company or any country around the world. And so we have the concept of what we like to call frontline integrity. And frontline integrity is basically applies to, I think, most governments, and then particularly to Home Affairs. And I'll tell you briefly why I think it applies to Home Affairs. Firstly, there's been quite a shift in the last 10 years in the investment environment. And, I mean, we're quite blunt about it. We sometimes have some interesting debates with colleagues or clients, for that matter, in Europe and America, who, and I mean, I think, Mr. Chairman, if, I mean, I tend to be a bit blunt in what I say, but there's been a vision, or there's been a sort of perception for many years that Africa is corrupt and certain Western countries are the bastions of integrity. And I think that myth has been deconstructed increasingly, because the U.S. Department of Justice introduced something called the FCPA, which is the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, and more we're seeing that large American corporations step forward, put their hands up and plead guilty to committing offenses of bribery. And as we always say, it takes two parties to form a corrupt relationship. The person receiving the money is corrupt, but certainly, and even in terms of our law, the person giving the money is equally guilty. And with this shift in emphasis, more and more foreign investors who are looking at levels of risk to invest in a country. I mean, security risk is important for them. So, for example, the threat of terrorism in the country decides whether they will invest there. But more and more, integrity in government is an indicator of risk for foreign companies because of legislation like the FCPA, and shareholders are increasingly saying we don't want our operations in countries that have high levels of corruption. Secondly, the second reason why the frontline integrity is essential for Home Affairs is, and I think this is too often forgotten by our public, our media, and maybe sometimes even our decision makers, our national security interests. Part of PASCA's emphasis is we provide security advisory work, and with the World Cup coming up, we inundated with clients, including some of the teams, saying, are we going to be safe? So, for example, PASCA has been appointed to advise the England football team on safety issues. We don't think we can advise them on how to win, but we can advise them on how to be safe. Can't advise them on what captain to have, but anyhow. Home Affairs is absolutely essential to national security because the first point of contact for people trying to infiltrate the country is often a Home Affairs representative, be it at a border post, an airport, or somebody trying to secure false passports or false identity documents. So the more obvious departments like security and public safety, intelligence, obviously have a key role in security, but it's most of the time it's Home Affairs officials who are actually literally in the front line. If they train to detect suspicious behavior and report it, we probably will be safe. If they're easily corruptible, our safety is at risk. And then, Mr. Chairman, I took the liberty of dubbing Home Affairs the mother of government, because in a sense it looks after the common people, the citizens of the country, more so than many of the other departments whose work is maybe not as frontline as Home Affairs. And so to a large degree, our belief is Home Affairs sets the tone for other government departments. If it's regarded as efficient, incorruptible, effective, dynamic, other departments will tend, we believe, or we hope, follow suit. So, what is integrity risk? Now, one of our key points is, and I don't want to go into it in too much depth now because I'm aware of time limitations, but we can come back to it should anybody wish. We define integrity very simply in terms of behavior. It's not what somebody thinks. It's not what they believe. It's not even a set of values they hold. For us, integrity is simply what people actually do. Because one can have great ideals and great values, but if you flip a suitcase of money that person's way, those ideals and values can very quickly disappear. So for us, for Home Affairs, we would define integrity risk as any behavior that threatens the strategic objectives of the department, the reputation of the department, the physical or psychological welfare of its personnel. Because again, you'll see that for us, integrity is way broader than a simple concept of honesty. If somebody is being abusive in the workplace, if somebody is being discriminatory in the workplace, that for us is a lack integrity. And it's worth mulling that point over. It could be threatening the physical or psychological welfare of DHA's clients, in other words, myself, Beau Carter, everyone sitting here when you are a citizen of the country rather than a member of parliament. Or it could be any behavior that threatens relationship with stakeholders, which includes other government departments, etc. So, in other words, it's any behavior which is likely to be embarrassing, disruptive, violent, abusive, illegal, or corrupt. And some of the common risks that are integrity issues are fraud, corruption, theft, workplace violence, something I don't think we pay enough attention to in this country, racism or prejudice, and this may be of interest, lack of diligence in performance of duties. Our definition of integrity includes that, and I may need to do a bit of convincing there. But so, revisioning integrity. Well, the media is often full of concepts of integrity, but they very seldom give any thought to what we mean by it. Is integrity honesty? And these aren't prescriptive, I'm sort of asking these as rhetorical questions. Most people would say being honest is the same as having integrity. Is it goodness? Now, however we define that, because often people think when we talk about integrity, we talk about a good person. Is it a person who's fair and judges people fairly? Is it somebody who's beyond temptation? Is it somebody who shares the same political ideals or values as me? And we put these points down because it reminds us that we actually very seldom have a working definition of integrity when we talk about integrity. And a good example is we have numerous clients that approach us, government and non-government, that said, can you do integrity screening on employees? And our first question is, how do you define integrity? And usually what they say is, we want to know if they have a criminal record. Well, the challenge is, and I remember having a particularly wonderful debate with the intelligence services of our country once, because most serious crimes committed in companies, the perpetrators do not have a criminal record to begin with. And it's useful to know if somebody's having a criminal record, but it should not exclude them from employment, as if having a criminal record is automatically an indicator of a lack of integrity. So, the key issue here, we have to try and avoid tying integrity to any specific moral, spiritual or other subjective value positions. I mean, people are entitled, obviously, to hold those positions. And in fact, they're guaranteed within our constitution. But we can't project those, our value positions, as definitions of integrity onto others. And so we have come up with something called PIMS, which I know is some colonial drink. But I assure you, in this context, it's not. It's the PASCO Integrity Management System. And at the heart of PIMS, it's a very simple and, well, we like to think it's simple, innovative, but effective approach to integrity, which is as follows. Again, we define integrity in terms of behavior. It's got to be consistent with the strategic objectives of the organization. I mean, that's a fairly broad concept, but it makes sense if one thinks about it. It has to be consistent with the expressed values of the organization. If an organization's value is to be non-discriminatory and fair, then the behavior of managers and employees should obviously be consistent with that. And that in itself is a part of having integrity. It needs to be consistent with the laws of our country, with the values and objectives of the Constitution, and our country's emphasis on human rights. So when people come to us and say, can you test an employee for integrity, this is, these are all the points we want to look at. And you obviously going to ask, well, how do we do that? And there are various ways we do it. But it's not a simple thing of saying, has the person ever stolen something? I got involved in a heated dispute with a government client last year who wanted to prevent somebody from gaining employment in a government department because 12 years ago they had appeared in court for shoplifting when they were 13 years old. And I said, it doesn't make sense. They've done nothing wrong since then. Their values are consistent with your values, etc., etc. But it was a little thing that said, if they have a criminal record, we can't employ them. And I think we need to relook a lot of those. And why I put all this in is, at the end of the day, for us, integrity is about compliance. It's, can I behave in the correct way when it's required of me? Taking a bribe is not behaving in a correct manner. Stealing is not behaving in a correct manner. Sexual harassment is not behaving in a correct manner. But very importantly, when we then need to take another step and say, compliance is very different to obedience. And I could talk for, in fact, in my academic days, I used to talk for 15 lectures on the difference between compliance and obedience. I assure you I'm going to do this in 2 minutes. Because otherwise it'd be until the State of the Nation address on Thursday. So, behavior is an object. The advantage is this, of the our integrity approach, and I'm going to come back to the compliance issue with, in relation to this. You see, behavior is an objective point of reference. If I can have a tick box that says this is the way a person behaves, I'm not imposing my beliefs of how people should behave onto them. I'm just saying, on one hand, we have how we need you or expect you to behave, and on the other hand, this is how you are behaving. If there's a complete mismatch between the two, we have a problem. Now, when we talk about compliance, that's what we mean. Just as there is a certain protocol within Parliament that has to be observed and followed, so within various departments is there a protocol. Sometimes it's written in the form of policies and procedures. A lot of it, in fact, is unwritten, and you put the two together, we talk about a culture. And departments and companies that have a culture of compliance actually consistently outperform those which do not have a culture of compliance. And the example I gave, or always give, is I once investigated a huge theft at a bank, and the guilty party had a subordinate who knew for 9 years that his boss was stealing. When I said to him, why did you never report it? He said, because he's my boss and he told me not to. And that is an example of obedience. Obedience is, I will do what I'm told to do. Compliance is, I will do the right thing. Consistent with the values of the department, or etc., etc. So if the value of a department is explicitly that one should report corruption or fraud or wrongdoing, and employees do that, they are being compliant. If they're told by superior not to do it, and they don't listen, they're being obedient. And the thing we try and do when we help companies turn around integrity issues is we say to them, the first step is convert yourselves from a culture of obedience to a culture of compliance. And that means assuring every single employee that if you do come forward, you will be protected. Probably, I'm sure most of you are aware of something in our law called the Protected Disclosure Act. Employees who come forward have the right to remain anonymous. if they threaten, there's moral and legal obligation on the department or the employer to protect them. But that is seldom implemented. So often employees are coming forward and saying, I'm aware of problems or I suspect problems. And what's happening, look, just in government, in various of our large companies out there as well, they've been told, we don't want trouble, you're not a surgeon, this is just a grudge, or you just don't like this person, we don't want the shareholders to find out, we don't want the media to find out. And so things have been quietly dealt with under the carpet instead of brought out in the open. The other advantage, or another advantage, of looking at integrity as behavior, as I said, is it's not subjective. You can't say, you're accusing me of a lack of integrity because you're a different religion to me, or you speak a different language to me, or you're a different gender to me. It's very simple. This is what's acceptable behavior, this is what isn't. And it actually helps them assess integrity, monitor integrity within departments, benchmark ourselves against other departments, for example, and then report it as required. And very importantly, it facilitates stakeholder relationships, because when you can say to a stakeholder, I think Bartata mentioned earlier, you know, the value of integrity and the importance of integrity in the Bafra King, but, we're not quite in the position of moral guardian, but part of our role is to assist within the group, saying, well, if we all speak the same language of integrity, it facilitates stakeholder relationships tremendously. And finally, most importantly, it allows us to be proactive instead of just being reactive constantly. Because one can go out there and promote integrity, because it's difficult to sit with a group of people and say you must have integrity, and you've got 10 people in a room and they have 10 different ideas of what integrity is. And I've dealt with too many interviews where I've interviewed, including many government employees, who admit to receiving bribes, or, and you say to them, well, weren't you aware it's wrong? And they say, well, I was aware in terms of the law it's wrong, but I didn't think that was wrong because so-and-so was just paying me, giving me a thank you for assisting them or helping them up. And you see, that's the problem, because in that person's thinking, it's not an integrity issue. In terms of our law, it is. There was another point. Apologies. In fact, I've covered that already. Oh, this is a bit blurred, but this is the implementation of this integrity management system. What we start with is, we start with what's called an as-is assessment. So we'll walk into an organization. Depending how large the organization is, we'll interview a sample of people. If it's small, we'll interview everyone. And we get their understanding of what integrity is and where the problems may lie within that organization. We'll look at whether the organization has explicit values. Sometimes the values are too vague. So for some organizations, the problem is the values are just too lofty and ideal. It's a bit like being parents sometimes. You know, if you say to your children you have to be good, it puts them in a tough spot, because what does being good mean? And it's impossible to be consistently good. But if you tell your children you should not steal, and if you ever do, you're going to be in serious trouble with me, that's clearer. That they can manage. But give them a sort of vague concept. You must always love your mother. You don't always love your mother. At times you want to do bad things to your mother. And so the minute you give somebody an objective they can't meet, they just abandon it. And so the starting point is to say, does the organization have explicit values that are realistic and that actually can be met on a day-to-day basis? Because integrity, it doesn't help if integrity is a part-time thing. It has to be an everyday thing. Every single day, a person will come in, get to their workstation, and on that day, they probably
sooner or later will have to fight a battle of conscience and morals and ethics, and if they've got explicit rules guiding them, it, I know I can't do this. So the second stage is we then do what we call a 2D design, and we identify integrity managers. And integrity managers are people within an organization that, firstly, their behavior has to show integrity. And again, we're not talking about, there's no such thing as a perfect person. We don't look for somebody that is Mother Teresa. When I was a lecturer, and I don't think it's the sort of thing, Mr. Chairman, I should say in Parliament, but if I can say when I was an academic and could say these sorts of things, I always used to say I was very mistrustful of Mother Teresa. I was always mistrustful of people that are just too good to be true. You never know what's going on behind the scenes. But as I said, that's what I used to say when I was a young radical academic. These days I'll just say that an integrity manager is simply somebody that consistently can meet the values of the organization and its code of ethics and conduct, but importantly is passionate about it and is willing to help and assist others to make sure there's no moral conflicts. It's a person that somebody can come to and say, I'm not sure if I'm allowed to do this, or this person has asked me to cover up for them, what should I do about it? And because the boss is often too busy, the minister, deputy minister, DG, DDG, these people are, quite honestly, too busy. And so our integrity managers are usually people in what we would call the middle management level. So somebody in a position of some authority, but who the common person working in the rank and file, so to speak, is comfortable to go and say, I'm unsure. I've been offered a bribe. How do I deal with this? Who do I report it to? Or I overheard Joe saying that for 10,000 grand he can do anything. He can arrange anything. Should I tell? Because Joe's my friend. But what do I do about this? And those integrity managers in departments actually become the sort of the guardians of integrity for the entire organization or department. And so what we do is we work, because we can't work with 10,000 employees, there's just too many, but we can work with 50 or 60 integrity managers. And it's a train-the-trainers approach. It's very much a capacity-building approach. And what we do is we work with them to develop and implement values, mission, policies, operational procedures. If this happens, what should be done? So, for example, with the Special Investigating Unit, which is 4,000 employees, we worked, in fact, with a small group of 10. And that small group formally, that project was so successful that that group formally became what they call the IIU, the Internal Integrity Unit. So those 10 integrity managers they put together in one unit, which I think has certain advantages and I think has certain disadvantages, because it's great having an internal integrity unit, but the minute it got formalized as such, that sort of value of that informal, I can go to Bert Harter and ask him something. It's very different to doing that, to going and knocking on the door where there's a sign saying internal integrity unit, and now everybody knows I've gone into the internal integrity unit, so I must have something to tell them. So we don't, internal integrity units are great, but they're different to integrity managers. Integrity managers are simply, it might be the secretary, it might be an assistant, it depends. And then we monitor reports and so the cycle goes on. So some examples, I've mentioned the SIU, I've mentioned SARS, I mentioned that was the bank I mentioned. I'm not going to waste your time with you myself. So the lessons learned, I think, is essentially integrity is something that can readily be turned around. I mean, we've walked in to some organizations that have pretty much been on their knees. We worked with one organization outside the borders of this country where out of a board of 7 members, 4 were facing criminal charges.
the organization was in chaos. Morale was at an all-time low. And there were all sorts of predators waiting to pick up the pieces. And within 9 months, it was turned around. And today, this organization is rated as having one of the strongest codes of governance and conduct in, well, it was a Ugandan corporation, I can mention that, one of the strongest codes of conduct and governance in probably in East Africa, and it simply revolves around let's start by rethinking what you mean by integrity and put it into practice. So integrity in the World Cup, I thought I need to, because everyone wants to talk about the World Cup. As I said, Home Affairs is in the front line in more ways than one for the World Cup. We know that the international media, for whatever reason, have decided to be very critical about this World Cup. They've overinflated all sorts of threats and risks. And as I say, I speak from a position of knowledge and experience on this, as we do the Security Advisory Board as well. I mean, all this rubbish about bulletproof vests and not understanding the geopolitical differences between Cabinda and Johannesburg is pathetic at best. But what it does tell us is there is going to be a very critical gaze on this country. And do not be surprised if certain unscrupulous paparazzi of that decide to let's go in with a hidden camera and see if we can get a false passport with enough cash. And they're going to love those sorts of stories because it's going to be, you see, we told you South Africa shouldn't host this. The fact that you could do the exact same with enough money in the middle of Washington is not going to appear. So I'm afraid it's a bit like saying your mother-in-law is coming to visit, so you make sure you're on your best behavior. Maybe I'm revealing too much personal information here, Mr. Chairman. I don't get on too well with mine. Integrity in Home Affairs is absolutely, and this is something I'm even more passionate about, because I was also the former director of the Crime Prevention Center at Rhodes University. And helped on the sidelines putting together a new South African police service, and I'm one of those citizens who, as a result of that experience, is fiercely protective of SAPS. Yes, there are many areas they should be criticized, but I always say until somebody spent 72 hours without sleep running around in a police van in the middle of the Eastern Cape that doesn't have heating in the middle of winter, then we can be critical. But integrity in Home Affairs will go a huge way to assisting the men and women in uniform, because again, it's the concept of frontline defense. We can stop a lot of the drug dealers and crime syndicates from infiltrating the country to begin with. It obviously plays a key role in social development. I think that I don't even need to go into there, in education. And finally, we've come up with the concept of integrity at work, which is trying to put all of these concepts together and say, you know, it's a bit like, and I have no interest in the company at all, but something that comes to mind, I think, you know, MTN, for example, has come up with their Ayoba slogan for the World Cup. For us, companies internally need slogans as well, and integrity at work is one that we like to give to organizations. And so, well, I mean, obviously you'd word it your own way, but that's essentially what it is. People coming to work every day need to have a sense that in my office, I have to protect, I have to sort of be a sentinel in a way and defend far bigger things than I. By showing integrity. And I think in Home Affairs, for example, the more people are made aware that they are the front line of defense, the better it goes. So I'm very happy to entertain any questions, and again, Mr. Chairman, we'd just like to, I think on behalf of for Sparta as well, our stakeholders. We'd just like to thank you for the opportunity and look forward to taking it further at any point.
Thank you very much, Dr. Wellman. I see there's already a hand up. First of the block, Madame. Thank you.
Thank you very much for a very informative presentation. I would like to ask, so it's essential that with newly appointed staff, and there's a lot of vacancies in Home Affairs, that they are properly vetted and trained. But how do you address the current morale and the current problems? And over, if you can, we've obviously run a bit of an analysis, how long do you think it will take to turn around the morale and the, basically the view that Home Affairs is intrinsically corrupt?
See if there are any other comments, questions, and then we'll take them as a basket, Dr. Wellman. Memo.
Chair, it was a good presentation, but I just wanted to find out if Dr. Wellman hasn't maybe met with the department to discuss what he has told us today. Thank you.
Thanks, ma'am. All right, ma'am. Okay, all right, okay. Chairman,
I think the second question is a simple one to answer, which is not yet. But, we'd very much like to meet and discuss. First question's more complex. But I understand exactly where it's coming from. And I think if I address it at a couple of levels. I mean, firstly, vetting of, you refer to vetting of new employees. Yes, it is essential, but, I mean, to be honest, I suppose suspicious may be too, in fact it's probably the wrong word, but they're so skeptical of current vetting procedures. I myself remain unconvinced that they work. What we, and yet some sort of vetting is essential, because if you bring somebody into your organization that is going to put the organization at risk, you're accountable for it. And how can you do that? Well, what we prefer to do is but it's not cost effective in huge organizations. But for example, in our I think the best example I can give is our own organization, which is 40 to 50 people. The way we vet people is we get a detailed, we sit with them and we interview them and we get a detailed understanding of them as a person, and we identify what we would call behavioral red flags. So a good example, excessive alcohol or drug abuse is a behavioral red flag. It doesn't mean if somebody drinks the oncoming, but if it's excessive, because firstly there's a high chance of absenteeism, secondly they could be short of money and therefore more tempted, third, etc., etc. But a good example to show you the problems of screening is if you look at our intelligence services, they do not want to accept people with, for example, impaired credit records. Now, if you take into account the 7 million South Africans at the moment with impaired credit records, and probably another 2 million on the way after Christmas last year, you're pretty much excluding 9 million South Africans from employment in any position regarded as sensitive. The problem we have with that is, and the argument for it is to say if somebody's in deep financial trouble, they're more susceptible to the bribe. Unfortunately, that's based on a sort of slightly outdated, outmoded Cold War intelligence recruiting strategy that said, the simplest way to get somebody to turn against the country and sell secrets is to offer them a lot of money. I think we've learned enough to know that that's the least likely route to succeed. The most likely, the most simplest way is find somebody with a grudge against their country, or find somebody whose ideology you can match and convince them that, that it's actually a good thing. So, I don't want to go into a long detour, but the point is there are problems with standard vetting procedures. Now, when you apply that to say, well, what do we do with the people that are currently there, the same issues apply. Because I know some departments and some organizations say, well, come in and test everyone we've got now present. The first problem with that is, what do you do if whatever test you're using, you fail, but you're actually already in the employ? Legally, you can't simply dismiss the person because they failed the test, which was never a requirement to enter to begin with. So do you, and then you end up put in the position, and I'm not agreeing or disagreeing with it, but I'm saying a little bit in the position of the American security services with their terrorist watch list, which is very controversial and probably not quite as effective as they hope it would be. So the best way for us of dealing with current problems is, as I indicated, is attempt to go in and start with a revisioning of integrity. I know this may not come across as popular, but in some organizations we actually have proposed an amnesty, where we say, right, if there have been particular problems with corruption, with dishonesty, etc., give a, and it's got to be a very limited period, I mean sometimes 2 weeks, 2 to 4 weeks, at which an employee can come forward and say, I have done wrong. And the complications around it, because if somebody comes in and admits a criminal offence, an amnesty from an employer actually holds no water. So you have to, it has to be dealt with very cautiously and applied to very particular circumstances. And, I mean, that's another long debate for another day. But what you want to do is you want to revision integrity. And you want to get a sort of common sense. And the Special Investigation Unit has given us permission to talk about the project we did with them. So what, and it wasn't that they had huge problems with integrity. For them it was more, they were a fairly new unit when we started this project. They inherited a lot of members from various other units like SAPS, SARS, the former Scorpions, and particularly as the Scorpions got the standard, a lot of them moved across to the SIU. And you had different people coming in with very different concepts of integrity that had been installed in them from their previous organizations. And so the first thing we did, as I say, was actually ask for people who were interested in playing the role of integrity managers. There were one or two who didn't have a choice because that was their job. So for example, the head of integrity and risk had to be an integrity manager. But there were a number of people that came and said, I actually would be interested in this because whatever it is, I like people, I'm passionate about it. Those people we vet very closely, because the one thing you cannot afford to have is an integrity manager that in the first 2 months is galloping off the rails on the front page of the newspaper, but then your entire integrity management project, I mean, you may as well sort of walk away from it. So we pay very careful vetting procedures to those individuals, and we also put in place a program to where, because a lot of people are going to be coming to them with some pretty intense integrity-related problems and concerns, and you have to make sure that they have counseling available should they need it, that there's a sort of 24-hour support line available should they need it. And as I say, we train them to work with and introduce concepts of integrity, and then importantly, we train each head of department to identify integrity problems. And I don't want to take too much time, but what I mean by that
is we have found, for example, if you look at banks as a typical example where they had problems with people stealing money, this is obviously a huge temptation for tellers who have access to this vast amount of cash every day. Change in lifestyle is the first risk indicator. I mean, the teller who 6 months ago was complaining about the price of bread, who suddenly, and we had one example where she was suddenly inviting colleagues around and serving lobster and caviar. And after she was found guilty, people around her colleagues said, we didn't think it was a bit strange. We didn't think it was a little bit suspicious. So don't believe the stories about winning the lotto. Often it's other more sinister explanations. People who suddenly go away sociable but become withdrawn and depressed. And our argument there is it doesn't matter whether it's an integrity issue or not. An employer should actually care enough to say, what's wrong? We notice you're not as cheerful as always or enthusiastic. If it's a home problem, maybe we can assist. If it's a financial problem, maybe we can give advice. If it's a work problem, we need to know. And so on and so on. And so we use about 20 of those sorts of indicators that people display every day without realizing it. And if managers, line managers, are taught to identify those and deal with them and know when to elevate them, but in fact, we believe, I mean, in some cases, it can reduce integrity problems like fraud or corruption or dishonesty by 80 to 90%. The time you asked in terms of turnaround, it's a tough one. If everybody's willing to sort of give some intensive effort to it, one can usually do it within months as opposed to years. And I mean, any project like this that's longer than 18 months is quite honestly isn't effective. So it would vary between 6 to 18 months depending on exactly what's required. I hope that answers without saying she's one, wouldn't it?
On the issue of morale, I think it's also about being able to recognize the homework-related issues. If you've got management that can be able to assist you in dealing with those kind of issues, I think that most people, most of the time, you have employees who don't know where to turn to with those kind of issues, which do actually impact on the work and into integrity and other issues. I think if you have managers which are trained well enough to be able to recognize those kind of issues, it will help the morale to some extent. That's what we've actually seen in our organization.
Thanks. I can see a welcome advocate, Matas. You are sufficiently at home to ask your question or make your comment now.
Being late. Yeah. I'd like to understand if you were to work with home office. How do you do that, given that the problem in home affairs is broader than the organization? It's societal, and also it relates to the whole issue of immigrants in South Africa in terms of numbers and the fact that they are not documented and are trying to legitimize themselves, which brings pressure to bear on home affairs, you know. Like this example you are talking about with the teller, you know. I always ask myself, how do you count money of so much money every day and you're underpaid? You know, I mean, I don't know how they survive. I won't survive that, counting that kind of money every day and I'm underpaid. So, you know, sometimes I feel you are asking the impossible from people if they are put in a particular environment. The home affairs people are bombarded by these immigrants. Every day, long queues outside. They know that these people are desperate for documents and they have the money. They are syndicates and so on. But we are asking these few officials to stand the pressure. You know, it doesn't matter what happens. Be strong. That's what we are asking. And is it a... Is it something we can do, all of us, under the circumstances? So, as much as I understand and I support
taken initiatives like this. But I'm of the view that we need a holistic approach and deal with other attendant problems that tend to contribute. Issues of borders and others, and a lot of these people who are in the country, and so on and so on. And also deal with this issue with the officials. But if we were to target officials in isolation, I think we're asking for too much from them. So that would be my remark.
Thanks, Advocate Matasa. I can see that you have provoked responses. Mrs. Treblanche, Honorable Treblanche, is surely to engage you.
Chairman, I shall attempt to avoid getting involved in the political debate, but I mean, I'm tempted to respond with a story of a policeman I worked with, a constable in the Eastern Cape, who, and when I referred to 72 hours in an unheated police van, I was working with him, and he had been, from the Transcon, had been a criminal himself, and when 1994 came along, he sat and reflected on things and decided it was also an opportunity for him as an individual to turn his life around. And we were working on a pretty sensitive case, and I can tell you he was offered 100,000 rand in cash to look the other way, and instead brought up in handcuffs and led the person away. Now, you see, and I fully agree about the holistic approach. And we would love to be given a brief to secure the border and solve all the problems, but we thought that might be a bit over and ambitious. But I think, I mean, with respect, where I disagree is that it's impossible under those conditions to expect the individual to be strong, as you put it, because in fact for us it starts with the individual. It's common to say, and too often I've heard violent criminals use the excuse of it's the society, it's the family I grew up in, my mother never cared for me. Because I always say that I've met many people who come from the same background and who didn't have parents and actually have worked their way up to something incredibly meaningful in life. And it comes down a lot to individual decisions, and integrity, we forget, is a decision. Now, if somebody's offered 50 rand, I was at one of the, I think you came off that, but we did security for some of the sports events as well, and I was at one of the precursors to 2010. This was meant to be as a dry run. And I was standing and watched as somebody drove their vehicle up to a secure entrance. I mean, this was the VVIP entrance. And in fact, the president of the country was inside. And the security guard at the gate said, "You cannot come in because you don't have a pass or accreditation." And I watched as this guy took out 200 rand and said, "This is my accreditation." And he was inside within 5 minutes. Without being searched, without any clearance, without any accreditation. Now, what we forget is that in that moment, that guard has a decision to make. Do I take the 200 grand, or do I call the police? And the point is, you can teach people and encourage them and support them to make those right decisions. Often it's not that they're thinking it through and analyzing it and making a wrong decision. The problem is often they're just not thinking about it. It's just not thought, it's automatic. And what you want is to make somebody pause and think. It's a bit like having a safety. There's a reason pistols have safety catches on, so that you think before you fire, or that's meant to be. Anyhow, and I didn't put it in this present situation. But what we did, for example, with the revenue services, and some days I think we did it too well because they phone and harass me, is they were looking for a taxpayer compliance model. And this is going back to the days of Mr. Gordon as Commissioner SARS. And his instruction was, he said, if you recall 20 years back, the revenue services were the joke of government. Nobody took the old apartheid era revenue services remotely seriously. Today, it's probably rated as one of the most effective government departments, not just in the country. I did a lot of work for SARS and consulting for SARS and traveled internationally talking to tax organizations and divisions, and it was amazing. For example, to go to Australia and have them say, well, South African Revenue Services, we can learn from. Because we turn compliance around, that it's now actually one of the higher rates of tax compliance in the world. And we introduced a very simple model, and the model, which I don't unfortunately have on here to demonstrate, but says you can encourage people to make the right decisions by doing four things. One is, and we call them pathways to compliance. One is, you reward them for doing the right thing. So if I report somebody trying to bribe me, I get some sort of reward. That reward doesn't always have to be financial. A letter of recognition from the minister, the president, can sometimes mean more than R1,000 bonus to somebody. It's the sort of thing they will go home and say, look what I've got. And for SARS, for example, we suggested find some way of thanking the public, which they have done. It's now the messages on TV, thank you for, at the end of a tax year, thank you to all those people. We suggested that they randomly phone taxpayers who submit on time and say, thank you very much. And if you think in your own life, you can identify with that. I got a phone call from my credit card company a couple of weeks ago, and I thought, right, I'm going to fight with this person because I know I've paid. And I started saying, listen. And he said, no, we just phoned to thank you for paying. And I thought, oh, well, it means a lot sometimes, a simple thank you. So when we say a reward, it may be financial, but it need not be. So that's pathway one. Pathway two is you have a persuasive threat of punishment when the person does something wrong. The emphasis has to be persuasive. If you do not pay tax, you will appear in court. You will be charged with a criminal offense. And chances are you may well go to jail. But if people don't see that happening, they're not going to take it seriously. And it has to have punch. So what SARS did, because they always had this policy of, in fact, they applied it more to where their own employees were guilty of corruption. And as I say, 20 years ago, SARS had enormous levels of corruption. It was common. Had to pay R10,000 in tax, the standard thing was you take a tenth of that, go to your local SARS official, hand them R1,000, and your 19,000 problem disappears. And SARS, they used to catch them, but they didn't want it known publicly, so it was always charge them but keep it quiet. And I think with Commissioner Gordon, he did it completely the opposite. SARS used to send out press releases saying such and such an employee has been charged, will be appearing in court, here's the court date, this is the offence. And they used to encourage journalists to come to the court and hear the person pronounced guilty and report it on the front page. And immediately the level of corruption within SARS started dropping dramatically. So now you're combining rewarding doing the right thing with punishing doing the wrong thing. But there are two other pathways that are a little bit more complex. The one is something called the process of extinction. And extinction doesn't mean taking people out and shooting them. It's a psychological term which means when if you want people to do the right thing, essentially take away the obstacles that prevent them from doing the right thing. So it's a little bit more complex.
in a SARS environment for taxpayers, what we said is simplify the process. If you want people to submit on time, don't expect them to sit and fill out 50 pages of how much does your grandmother earn. The simpler you make it, the more likely. You can ideally get it down to one page. This is what I earned. This is what I paid you already. Here's the proof. Thank you. There you go. 95% of people will submit on time. And it's just like, I mean, quite honestly, I suppose that may have some relevance in the home affairs environment. Sometimes the processes, the procedures are just so complex that people are engaged in corrupt activity, not because they're corrupt by nature, but just if I don't have time for this. I mean, I'll be honest, I've tried that myself at times as well. I can't face the thought of standing in this queue for 6 hours. There's got to be somebody around there who's willing to take some sort of shortcut from me. And then you end up feeling like you owe that person something. So a lot of it is about simplifying processes. In an integrity environment within the department, that means the policies, procedures, etc., employment policies, conditions of work have to be as simple as possible. It's got to be black and white. It can't be room for ambiguity and misunderstanding. If you take a bribe, there's no, well, I didn't understand all this. It was just a thank you because I helped the person out. It's, if you take money from a citizen, you are guilty. The disciplinary process must be quick. We need to move away, and I know this is going beyond the scope, but from things being bogged down at CCMA level for 6 months to a year, I think that's half the problem with corruption in this country. And we know, because on an investigative front, I mean, we routinely catch the people that are guilty, and they smile at us and say, I'm not going to be fired, but I'll see you at the CCMA. And if you want to look holistically, I think I'm passionately supportive of employees' rights, and particularly the unfairly dismissed, but we also have to be supportive of employers' rights, because we have employers saying to us, should we really fire this person because, you know, they stole 200 rand from the secretary's desk? And he's saying, yes, you fire them, but it doesn't matter if it's 200 or 20,000, it's theft. But when you think what it's going to cost us, that this, you know, to go through the CCMA and this appeal, and you know, my own personal view, but based on our experience, is a lot of the integrity problems in this country would be solved by revisiting how bodies like the CCMA work. And we're very supportive of them, but it's gone a bit amok. And then the fourth and final way is, I said, remove obstacles. So we've got, just to recap, we've got to remove the obstacles which are in the way of people behaving. We've got to punish people when they behave unfairly. We've got to reward people. And the final way is basically combining the three of those into essentially one package, and making sure that they consistent. So that's the final pathway, is essentially an integrated path that says make sure that it's consistently applied, make sure that it's clear. And so, I mean, we implemented that within the SARS environment, which has the same issues. It's still the broader corruption and the need for a holistic approach, which I agree with entirely. But I think what we showed in the SARS environment is you can start and work from the bottom up. And it actually spreads fairly rapidly through the organization. And it became something of a passion within the organization. I mean, you know, we saw the sort of transformation happening where people were suddenly proud to work for SARS. And they came to work with a sort of lift in their step, and their interactions with members of the public changed, and members of the public's perceptions of SARS changed. And amazingly, I mean, we did a lot of work with some of the people might remember him. They went on to be Deputy DG of Intelligence with Pete Richer, and there's And he was commenting that what was amazing is suddenly how people from the public would start phoning the hotline to say, I'm aware that this employee of yours is doing wrong. So they become aware that SARS would do something about it. And I think there is a lot to be learned from the SARS model. So, thank you, Dr. Wang. Dr. Matas?
I see that you presented my Marxist ideas. talking about the pathway number two, I think for me that's the really most decisive of this package. And that's the one we've really seen working. And that's the one, the lack of application of has caused most problems in the government service. In terms of action, because most of the departments have got congestion of disciplinary actions, which are never taken to the end. And I think I agree with you there that that's one of the critical issues. As you say, then the public, once they realize that actual action is taken, then people then move. Because it does influence the culture. Because the other employees realize that the chances are if you are caught, you will be transferred. Then people don't mind a transfer because it gives them another opportunity. So, yes, that's one to comment.
Mr. Chair, I made this assure my the honourable member that in fact I was a Trotskyist myself as a student, so I do not entirely reject the Marxist philosophy to the ideas of the broader issues, but thank you.
Thank you, Professor. Honourable to Branch, are you fine?
I'll engage the advocate on a later stage because it basically implies that everyone's corrupt at specific circumstances because you've got, you're underpaid or whatever, you've got to pay something else, and that as if opportunity arises, anyone will take a bite, and I vehemently I won't, and I've never been offered one.
What I like about my committee, it's difficult to fall asleep here. But I'm always engaging on the issues. Am I all right? Okay. Good folks, it seems I can squeeze no further comment out of my members. I would like to thank both of you, Dr. Wellman, Kosi, for your time with us today, sharing your experiences. The representatives of the department are obviously here, and they've listened to your presentation. From our side, as members of parliament, we obviously appreciate the value of your presentation and its impact. We view it against the representations that we've had from the department and the challenges that the department has faced over the years and is currently facing. Unfortunately, I do not have the authority, nor does our committee have the authority, to say to the Department of Home Affairs, Home Affairs, work with HESCO. But we have the ability to try and persuade, to say that the Department of Home Affairs, are you aware of HESCO? They've made a presentation to us. They've mentioned quite a number of issues, principles, that we think are very relevant to the department. So I don't think they'll be hostile to hear from you. But whilst I'm speaking, I can see the Minister's parliamentary liaison officer would like to say something. You may, sir. Before I close. Yeah.
Thanks very much. I got so tempted when I got this overwhelming substantive presentation. As Minister is using, as the Portfolio Committee knows, the approach of partnership with the communities, the stakeholder forum. There's one stakeholder forum, after a long debate about corruption, decided that the minister should allow them, you know, to undertake to conduct a summit on corruption. Now, we struggle, you know, to get the content into it. Now, I got so tempted, Chair, that if we could have the details, or maybe if it is possible to involve them in getting through, you know, to the eventual summit, that will have consequences, warn people. It looks like out there people are so tired of corruption. Now, from that small world in Lusiki Fiki, that stakeholder forum would like to have a very, you know, a substantive kind of an approach towards warning and discouraging people from undertaking to do corrupt acts, especially around the enabling document of Home Affairs and the other sister departments which are also involved. So I wanted your permission, Chair, so that I can have a word with them.
Our responsibility, obviously, as a parliament is to facilitate, bring stakeholders to the department. So what I would say you should be doing after our meeting here is to obtain their contact, and I'm sure they would be willing to engage the minister even before that stakeholder forum, where they can meet and then exchange ideas and say, this is what we skills we have on offer. This is how you can utilize us. This is how we can partnership with the department. I'm sure they are here. They are not ancestors. They can speak for themselves. I'm sure they would be privy to want to participate in that type of partnership. So from our side, we can only encourage that type of activity. Good doctor. Coach, if you want to make a reply to...
Obviously, from practical point of view, I think it would be very pleasant that that you engage to give you the broader understanding of who the what capacity they have and what skills that they possess currently. I think what's good about PASCO is that they also operate in about 40 different countries, you know, so there's a lot of benchmarks that we can also bring to the party in that sense. And I think that again, from a local context, you know, Africa has an investment in PASCO. There's a lot of like things that we can also share as a community as to how that affects us. I mean, we have so many different stories you know, one couldn't share them, they're the concept at the time, but even look at the social political dynamics of our country, it's only pertinent that, you know, as a community you operate with like the utmost integrity to be able to engage with different stakeholders at different levels. And I think PASCO having come to, well, having invested in PASCO, and that's good for us being able to, you know, maintain a certain kind of brand out there in the market insofar as how we deal with our, you know, your above the line investors and your stakeholders at ground level. I mean, we've had issues where we've had migrant laborers coming to our community, and the thing is that for people who live in our community, they obviously, the rental agreement that they have with these guys who stay in the back houses, they make money. And let's make sure that one time was about more than 10 years of money being changed hands in our community, you know. But the problem is that like now, what happens is some of them, when their siblings pass away, they would actually dig under the facts and bury the people, you know. And then obviously create more like social problems. And these issues that, you know, we have to look at ways of dealing with kind of issues. And I think with this kind of like involvement or partnership with PASCO, that helps us to be able to get to the root causes and help us to find ways into how to deal with those kind of like problems. So I think there's more that we can share with you on those kind of issues.
Thank you very much. So at least
that opens your channel directly with the department. Gentlemen, thank you very much. So I'm sure you can speak with the officials of the minister and deputy minister, and then we'll stay in touch. We just have two items to deal with. Yeah. Members, can we have a 5-minute break? I'm not sure if there's still tea. Masizole, you're welcome. I appreciate you did the swap. Oh, she's back. I thought you were done the swap. But I'm glad to have both of you. I feel blessed. Yeah. So I'm not sure. Do you have tea, Eddie? No tea. We are too poor to afford tea. Unless the passers-by have drank it. Oh. May I suggest that you just have a 5-minute break? The rest of our agenda will be very short.
Hello. Diego. Hi. Oh, yeah, it's okay. Okay. Today is meeting, yeah.
I'm right back in high ground.
The second item on the agenda, you see that we have had an invitation from, in the main, the Committee on Sports for a joint visit with the Tourism Portfolio Committee, Police, and I'm not sure if there are others, to Swaziland, Botswana, and Zimbabwe, as well as Lesotho, to check our entry points that we share with those countries. Again, to do a state of readiness, like the previous visit that we took to look at some of our borders. So the main purpose of this visit would also be to do likewise. And then the first meeting, I was invited there with the chair of sports and the chair of tourism. The chair of police wasn't there, but they have engaged with the chair of police portfolio committee. So if there are developments since the last meeting that I attended, and in that particular meeting we had also invited the portfolio committee secretary and the portfolio committee researcher. So if there are any additions that you'd like to make, gentlemen, please feel free to do so. Eddie, starting with you.
Okay. As the chair said, we had that meeting, and then after that, there was a letter written by the chairperson of sports to the house chairperson regarding that meeting, that no, the three chairpersons met. And then about this proposed study tour and oversight visit. And then it was submitted to the House Chair. And then after that, we did an application. Each committee has to do an application, because we were told that, you know, there's money beside money that has been allocated to the portfolio committees. There's money that we will be able to access and use for that oversight visit. Then the proposed dates that we have put down on the application is from the 22nd up to the 3rd of April. I know that the 22nd is a holiday, but we're proposing that now if we leave in the evening, if it's approved, 22nd of March.
Oh.
Yeah, because we needed to do this before the soccer cup, so there was no time. So we have put down that application. If it's approved, those are the proposed dates, then finishing on the first. Then the chairperson mentioned the countries, but also we also need to do an oversight to Bombela, that is Nelspruit, Bulukwane, that will be Bloemfontein again, and Rustenburg. So those countries and along the Southern region also that they have been identified, Swaziland, Lesotho, Zim, and Botswana.
Okay. May I just add that the issue of the parliamentary program, the issue of the constituency period, has been engaged very closely with the chair of the House chairperson that's responsible for committees, Mr. Obed Patela. So the final dates there, it's negotiated with the people concerned, including the House chair. So as soon as we have finality around those dates, we'll share them with you. Okay, Eddie, let me give you, and then I'll give you a chance to engage members.
One last issue from my side is that for members who will be traveling, who need to have official passports, for those who don't have official passports, once we receive the application, I will have to have members who do not have official passports to be assisted to have those passports. So that will be much easier. So I don't know how many will be having official passports currently.
That's a matter that you sort out with canvas with the individual members. Will tell you. I'm sure those who have official passports will inform you. Can I take you, Adam, and then before I avail the opportunity to members, if there's anything that you'd like to
say? Just what I'm working on so far is we're working on a group with a group presentation or a group paper on all the issues specifically related to 2010 in these countries. So it's an international look at the countries we're going to be visiting, largely focused on security considerations. So that's what we're working on. And so I think that's going to be the general...
Thank you, gentlemen. Honorable Terblanche?
Yes, sir. I would just like to request, I hear what you're saying, that the concerns are being raised with the chair of committees, but I mean, there is a parliamentary program for a reason, and we've helped to have constituency periods, because for some of us, constituency periods are very important times in engaging and doing certain things, and we've got certain responsibilities in our constituency. So that's why we actually follow the parliamentary program.
Honorable Terblanche, I'm sure there's nobody in their right mind who can disagree with you. We all love and take seriously the parliamentary program. So if there are any issues that need to be attended to, that would be noted very carefully. In our engagement already, as I say, on the first day, we pointed out to all concerned that there's a parliamentary program. What we need to do is to try and meet this as much as possible. Members, is there anything else in regard to this that you'd like to raise? But from my side, we'll keep you informed as we get more and more information so that you can interact with the information. The third item on the agenda, I've been told that the Film and Publication Board, I haven't seen a written notice, but I'm told that they are withdrawing this invitation. Is that correct, Eddie? Is this what you told me this morning? Yeah. So until I've received a written communication, it's neither here nor there to me.
I can't hear by word of mouth. I must have written communication. They must say why they invite us and then decide to withdraw the invitation. So I'm still owed the courtesy of that information, written information. So if there's nothing else that you'd like to comment or say, that brings me to the end of this particular meeting. Adam?
All right, sir. Just in, as regards the State of the Nation address happening on Thursday, I'm not sure if all the new members are aware, but one of the things that happens after the State of the Nation and in preparation for the budget is analysis of all the various government departments. So that's something that we'll be working on and be making available to members as soon as possible after the State of the Nation address to assist them in their debates and deliberations. So just to make them aware that that's going to be available.
Adam, we appreciate that, and we'll obviously appreciate it to have it as soon after the State of the Nation address. But I'd just like to remind you that we are all new members. Some of us might be brand new second-hand, but we are all new members. We've had a new lease of life. Good folks, thank you very much to everyone who has attended in your various responsibilities and roles. Greatly appreciate it.